Excuse me. May it please the court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Curtis Mercer. There is no dispute that on April 23, 2008, Mr. Mercer engaged in unlawful and horrendous conduct. But what he did not do was commit the offenses of burglary first degree and kidnapping. In order for the state to establish burglary first degree, it was required to prove that Mr. Mercer entered the victim's home unlawfully at night with the intent to commit a crime, in this case it was theft, causing physical injury. None of Mr. Mercer's conduct caused physical injury. In Section 11 Dollar Code, Section 222, Subsection 23, and in this court's recent decision of Harris v. State, it is clear that physical injury requires either an impairment to a bodily organ or a function of the body, or substantial pain. Here, the state argues that the victim suffered both impairment to her body and substantial pain as the result of minor scratches and abrasions, purported swelling of her ankle, and some discomfort. However, the state has failed to prove that at trial. Here, after the incident in this case, Ms. Sutton, the victim, went to several hours later, went for a standard forensic examination. She did not seek medical treatment. It was at that actual examination that the abrasions and the scratches were noted. There's no indication that the victim herself actually noticed those until they were pointed out. There was no bleeding, there was no trauma, and there were no cuts. And there's no testimony or any other evidence at trial that any of her bodily functions were impaired. The only evidence that comes remotely close to establishing any pain is that of her comment regarding when she was engaged in non-consensual sex, that it hurt and made her cry. What the state fails...
Well, can't the jury draw inferences from other facts in the case? You don't have to have exact words from her, do you? For instance, throwing her down the stairs, that happened, right?
That's correct.
Would that, apart from the burglary charge, would that constitute an assault?
It could, but they didn't charge it that way. And what happened here...
Well, if there's an assault, isn't there physical injury?
Well, it depends on the level of assault, I guess. There was no physical injury, okay, because based on the subjective and objective tests that are required, which is what substantial requires. It's not just simply pain. It's substantial pain in this case. The objective test is required. In fact, cases in New York have said, and in this court actually, even if the victim got up there and said, I felt substantial pain, that's not enough because that's actually a subjective indication of the pain. And so to prove the assault or the burglary, if the subjective level wasn't raised, met, then no, there's no assault and there's no burglary. And here, her testimony, the only thing that came close was that it hurt, did not rise to the objective level of establishing the length, the duration, and the extent of the pain. And that's what several cases stated in New York and Oregon, which seem to be the only states that have physical injury issues, they, for the most part, they looked at cases involving a victim's testimony of substantial pain, saying that's too subjective, there's not enough objective evidence there. Someone saying that the defendant hurt her was subjective, it wasn't objective. We're not dealing with pain. It's substantial pain, which requires an objective test.
Well, when you consider that there were two or more forcible episodes of vaginal intercourse, wouldn't one conclude that the jury could infer substantial pain?
No, because there was no testimony of that. She said it hurt. And in fact, these cases that address this deal with...
Well, she said more than that, didn't she?
She said it hurt and made her cry. That was her testimony.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, can't one infer from that there was substantial pain?
No, that's not enough objective evidence as to the level of pain. One could infer she suffered pain, not substantial pain.
The review standard in this particular case is plain error, which means that you're asking us to find that the trial judge should have essentially dismiss the case sua sponte. Is that correct?
It is plain error, Your Honor. That is correct. However, this court and other cases such as Monroe versus State has addressed sufficiency of the evidence claims under plain error and found that the trial court should have thrown out a charge because there was not sufficient evidence.
Well, let me ask you a question about the way I read your reply brief. The state in its answering brief seemed to focus on the swollen ankle. And in your reply brief, you seemed to suggest perhaps the swollen ankle would have been enough to sustain the charge. But the only thing we have in the record is the police officer observing the swollen ankle, and there wasn't a connection to the episode. And in light of the fact that she was thrown down the stairs, why wouldn't there simply be enough circumstantial evidence for the jury to conclude that the swollen ankle and bruising that the officer observed related probably to being thrown down the stairs?
Because the test is not the horrendousness of the crime, not the intensity of the crime. The fact that he threw her down the stairs or just pushed her is irrelevant. What is relevant is what resulted from that, what was caused as a result.
Well, that was the thrust of my question.
I'm sorry.
That if she did have a swollen ankle and they had said unequivocally, I sustained the swollen ankle when he pushed me down the stairs, would you be making the same argument?
Yes, I apologize, I misunderstood. Yes, it would be the same argument, because what needs to happen is they need to show one of two things, substantial pain or impairment. The fact that they're simply swelling isn't of itself an impairment. In fact, in New York, People versus Goins, the court stated that when the complainant's eye and wrist had bruises on it and there was swelling and tenderness as a result, that was not an impairment. Here, we only have the officer saying it appeared to him to be swelling. She never indicated at any time when these occurred. Now, while a reasonable jury could conclude that it resulted from this incident, it goes to show that she was not impacted to the point where she suffered pain that amounted to substantial pain or was impaired. There was no testimony or from the nurse or anyone else that as a result of her swollen ankle she wasn't able to walk on it. The state offers an argument that there are times when swelling could in fact lead to impairment. There just simply isn't that evidence in this case.
Well, in King, we held that evidence other than medical treatment can sufficiently establish that an injury occurred. So are you contending that there must be medical testimony?
No, absolutely not. There must be some evidence that shows reaches an objective level. Medical testimony may be one, okay? Mm-hmm. But in this case, the officer, that was the argument there, was not necessarily, this particular argument was there should have been medical testimony, and that's not what we're dealing with.
When you talk about objective evidence, it sounds like what you're saying is that anything other than the testimony of the victim.
No, it would sound that way. However, what the cases have interpreted it to mean is some evidence about the extent of the injury, the length of the injury, the nature of the injury. Perhaps if she had testified, as one example of evidence, that as a result of this, my ankle was swollen and I wasn't able to walk on it for weeks and it hurt so bad, you know, it felt like it was a throbbing. Okay, there was none of that here. And there has to be a reason for the word substantial. I think if we take away the word substantial, we're closer to the state establishing some type of pain. But they didn't do that here. And one of the things with respect to the impairment was that the forensic nurse noted that there was no cuts, and she made that distinction. She said that she suffered abrasions and bruising. The cases where courts have found that there's an impairment to the skin have found that there were to the level of cuts creating infections, and that abrasions and bruises are not enough to impair the skin organ. And additionally, the state makes a passing argument with respect to the knee that it had to be impaired because there was a bruise above it and a bruise below it. There's absolutely no evidence discussing how in any way that impaired her knee.
So there was no motion for a judgment of acquittal, Your argument is that notwithstanding what you've described as the nature of her injuries, that that evidence was insufficient as a matter of law, and the judge should have simply said, I'm not letting this go to the jury for them to make a determination on first-degree burglary. I'm only, at the most, going to submit second-degree burglary.
That's correct. The evidence just wasn't there, and the focus ended up then being allowed the jury to focus on the horribleness of what actually happened, and that's not what the focus is to be on.
Now, the jury was instructed on second-degree burglary?
Yes, it was, and I agree with the state that that would be the remedy here. It would be downgraded to burglary, too.
All right, but the difference, basically, is whether or not the physical injury occurred?
That's correct.
So this specific issue had to be determined by the jury based on the evidence presented.
That's correct. And, however, when they decided to give the lesser included, there really wasn't much discussion about why burglary 2 versus burglary 1 or burglary 2 should be given. However, in his argument, the defense attorney did argue kind of obliquely that there was no physical injury here.
And do you want to turn to your next argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. The state argues that Mr. Mercer kidnapped the victim in this case. In Weber versus State, as the court is aware, this court set forth the factors in determining whether someone is restrained for purposes of kidnapping. What the court has to look to is a substantial interference with another's liberty by movement or confinement without consent. And the court goes on to define substantial interference of one's liberty requires much more interference than that which is ordinarily incident to the underlying offense.
Ms. Walker, the state appears to argue that, does argue that each of the rapes was a separate incident. Because the victim was deprived of her freedom in between each of the incidents and after, that with the intent of repeating the rape, that was confinement that was unnecessary in relation to it wasn't just incidental to the underlying offense. Your argument appears to be that this is one single event.
Right.
Would you agree that that's basically the issue that we have to decide here?
Yes, I would agree with that.
So that if we were to find, as the state argues, that these were separate events rather than one event with moving parts, so to speak, there would be no basis for reversing on the kidnapping conviction.
Yes, but I want to distinguish between events and actual offenses. One of the things that this court's decisions have not really looked at, and Weber is a good example.
Well, the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Is the fact that when there are multiple offenses taking place, it says the underlying offense, which is kind of hard to analyze when you're dealing with several offenses. If it was his intent to rape her four times versus one time, or is that kidnapping or restraint incident to that? And what's interesting is in Weber, and I looked at it a couple times, and I couldn't quite clearly find a distinction there between one event and several events. It said that there was a fight that went on for a period of time throughout the house. Well, that indicates that there's more than one assault. In fact, he slammed her up against the wall, and he prevented her from going outside by grabbing her hair and her arm. So in that case, there's more than one offense occurring. In this case, that is also true. And now, with respect to the events, if his intent is, I'm going to rape this woman four times, then I want to cover my tracks. So I got to make sure she stays in this house until that is done. That means that the restraint is incident to those offenses. Versus the cases where, for example, the recent decision in Wright versus State where the robbery was concluded and then he duct taped her. Or they took the person from the scene, like in Coleman versus State. Or when Sanders left her tied up, left and came back, was not necessary. Here, this is similar to Weber. There was an ongoing series of things occurring. While the rapes were separate, they were actually interrupted by his then attempt to clean up after that, so to speak, and then engage again. So it was actually one part of a moving set of parts, as Your Honor indicated. So as a result of that, it was, in fact, incident to the underlying events.
Was there a separate life sentence imposed in the kidnapping conviction?
I believe it was only 2 years, if I'm correct.
All right.
And because he had four life sentences.
And on the burglary one?
2 years as well, I believe.
And did you want to save the remainder of your time?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Justice Howland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the State of Delaware. The argument that is made now, as the Court has already pointed out during appellant's argument, is one that was never made below. This Court has said in Monroe that generally, if you don't raise sufficiency of evidence in a judgment of acquittal, you have a very high climb. In fact, that you must prove plain error or that the interests of justice require this Court to then delve into a sufficiency of evidence question. It's not that the Court never has a part, but particularly when we're talking about an issue like physical injury, that climb should be even higher. And the reason is this. It depends greatly on people watching another person describe what happened to them, how they felt, and what injuries, what type of things occurred to them. Looking at the photographs, which there were numerous, including the ankle and all the abrasions and all of the scrapes and the other marks that were on the victim in this case, and listening to her description of it and the nurse's description of it. It's a very personal type of situation.
Well, are you arguing, when you say a higher climb, are you arguing for a different standard of review or standard as a matter of law?
No, I do believe that plain error has to be it, but I suggest that when, as the appellant has raised the New York cases, one of the lines in the New York cases which describes the review in this particular type of case, and it comes out of the Philip A. case, which seems to be the one for the New York Superior Court's Appellate Division.
You're arguing that the Rule 8 interests of justice criterion or test is a door opener. That is, that's a test that has to be passed before we even get into plain error review.
I believe so. And I believe that Monroe says that, that the interest of justice.
Monroe, there was, according to the court, little or no evidence. It was clearly insufficient.
Yes.
But as I understood your argument, and you seem to also be saying that if there had been a motion for a judgment of acquittal or a otherwise timely application to the court, it would have been appropriate under the facts of this case for the trial judge to deny it and say that the degree of injury or the degree of pain is a jury question. And they are, there's enough to go to the jury.
Yes. In the state's view, this isn't even a close call. 13 different areas of this lady's body were affected by what occurred to her. And to say that she couldn't pinpoint which action caused which abrasion or bruise, she was never asked that question. And part of the reason, and that's why it's very important to raise motions for judgment of acquittal and to allow, for instance, if there is a question, and the defendant certainly had no question in this case, in fact, defense counsel, during the prayer conference, indicated, well, the only real question is whether or not he caused the injury, not whether there was injury. In fact, that was his argument in closing to the jury, whether he caused the injuries that were so obvious to everyone because they were there in photographs, and a jury can infer. We're all human beings. When we see a photograph of a bruised and swollen ankle, one of the first things we probably do as human beings is go, ooh, looks like it hurts, because we know that. And so there was no reason to ask further questions. Interestingly, Harris was decided a week after this jury decided this case, and perhaps if Harris had been out before, the prosecutor might have asked more questions, but there really was no need to. Everyone in that courtroom saw those photographs, listened to the victim, listened to the nurse who described the various injuries and what they meant, and understood that there was physical injury. That's why the defense attorney didn't just blow it by not having a motion for judgment of acquittal. The judge didn't just blow it by not sua sponte saying, wait a second, this isn't even close. It's because the evidence was so clear. If there was a motion for judgment of acquittal, it would never have been granted.
Mr. Wallace, I just want to focus for a moment away from theory and on what's at stake on this appeal. Ms. Walker tells us that on the burglary one conviction, there was a two-year sentence. Is that correct?
I would have to double-check my nature and situation. I don't believe he received a life sentence on that, Your Honor.
Right.
And in fact, he wouldn't be. He was not a habitual criminal, so I can say with surety it wasn't a life sentence.
And would that also be true for the kidnapping?
Also, life was not a possible sentence, so it's something less than life. I'm not exactly sure what the years are.
And you had no reason at this point to contest, you know, what defense counsel told us. But there were two or three consecutive life sentences that were imposed here for the rapes?
There were multiple life sentences. Yeah. I cannot remember the number. Actually.
So no matter what happens in this appeal, this defendant is going to be in jail for life, at least one life, and maybe more.
Absolutely.
And what is the utility, you know, in where we're dealing with physical violence, that is, violent offenses of this kind, and adding burglary one and perhaps kidnapping to the panoply of charges?
Well, Your Honor, in making a charging decision, trying to determine what the jury may find the person guilty of or not is never an easy call.
Whatever we do here, even if we were to reverse on both of the convictions that are appealed from, while it may be a nice exercise in legal writing, it'll have no practical impact on this particular defendant, isn't that correct?
That's true. I don't know whether the court is asking the utility of fighting this on appeal or the utility of initially charging.
Well, both.
Well, the utility of initially charging is this was an extremely serious and dangerous crime committed in the worst possible way. This was a nightmare for an innocent woman.
Right, and so if the state somehow failed to prove rape, it would get him on burglary?
Burglary 1 and kidnapping are Class B felonies, Your Honor, which carry with them 2 to 25 years. So, yes, if for some reason the jury bought some part of his story or, in fact, had merged certain of the rape incidents, there were different rape incidents, and there are times when jurors might buy a theory like Ms. Walker's that this was all just one rape. That makes a huge difference in the sentencing aspect. As to why to fight it on appeal, obviously we don't want that law. We do not believe that somebody who has 13 different areas of their body affected by a tremendous assault like this.
I wasn't asking why you're defending the appeal.
Okay. Yeah. I suggest that what's missing in all of the cases that the defense raises in this situation is the constellation of different things that occurred to the victim in this case. It's not just a cut lip, or it's not just a bruise, or in Philippe, the slapping that the court noted there. It's multiple, multiple, multiple. This woman was beat up, for lack of a better term. Anyone who saw her afterwards and saw all this would probably cringe and say, yeah, that looks like it hurts. And probably that's the very reason, other than showing the pictures and having her describe. And she did note. She was specifically asked and went through those pictures. She was asked by the prosecutor, Did you have that mark on your body before this? Did you have this mark on your body before that? That's noted by the state in its appendix. It's specifically at B11. She noted none of those things.
Was there in the record a specific description of the length of the stairs? So if, when she went down the stairs, how far that was?
I cannot tell the court that I recall that. I don't know if there were pictures. I just don't recall whether or not there was.
Where was the exchange in the record you described? I know you mentioned the closing argument where the defense questioned whether these injuries had been inflicted by the defendant. But you seem to suggest the record reflects some exchange with the judge where the defense attorney acknowledged the issue in the case is not the degree of the injuries, it's whether the injuries were a result of his conduct.
Your Honor, that would be our appendix B32, and the specific statement that I would note from the defense attorney was, it would go to whether or not the jury would want to believe he left, did not harm her, and those injuries occurred, and he was saying occurred later or at some other time, because he questions that in the closing argument at page 71 on June 16th transcript. He, in his closing argument, poses the question to the jury, how do we know that these injuries occurred from this? It was always, did Mercer cause what the pictures are that you've seen and that? Because his defense was, this was consensual, I didn't leave this person harmed at all, she's just making this up type thing.
So let's turn to the kidnapping issue.
Yes.
As I understand your brief, your application of Weber turns on the temporal interruption between the events. And in this case, the judge did look at that the way we suggested had to be done in Weber and said, I'm not dismissing this as a matter of law. It's a jury question. And that in this case, the record supports that the time between the events that involved restraint or confinement were more than you needed for the continual multiple sexual assaults. Is that right?
Yes.
So your conclusion is it properly went to the jury, and there's evidence to support the jury's verdict.
Absolutely. Everything that should have been done under Weber was done right. The jury was instructed properly. The judge did the analysis that he should have done ahead of time. And the evidence was more than sufficient. In both Wright, the most recent kidnapping case this court decided, which involved robbery, and now this case, which involves rape, the defense wants to argue that as long as it had something to do, really, with the rape, if it made it either easier for them to commit the rape or, as Ms. Walker mentioned just recently, to prevent detection, that that's enough. Well, if we go back to both the code commentary, and then we look at this court's progression of cases along the way, Coleman, Burton, even Weber. The question is the restraint merely that which is ordinarily incident to the crime? Because rape involves some level of physical dominion over the other person. You almost, by definition, restrain in some way their movement or control them in some way. And that's what the commentators made clear. They wanted to ensure that not every rape was also a kidnap.
That leads to my question, which is, let's change the facts for a moment and assume that rather than having two or three separate rape episodes, we just had one. And the events that occurred were otherwise the same, but excising those other two rapes, would your position be the same?
I believe it would. If we're talking about him also remaining in the home for 2 hours and moving her about as he did, and we're just saying there isn't that second episode of going back to the bedroom and again attacking her sexually, I suggest it does. The reason the state obviously looks to the fact that there are these two is that it much more clearly fits into this court's jurisprudence from Burton, where it made it very clear.
The hypothetical case that I posed to you gets closer to the issue or the concern that every time one commits a rape, it automatically constitutes a kidnapping. Your argument is, well, not in these particular circumstances, even if there was only one rape. What would have to happen? That is, how would the facts have to be changed for this defendant to avoid being in jeopardy for kidnapping as well as rape?
Well, I would suggest that had he gone into the home, taken her, there had been one sexual episode, and then he immediately left, it was a matter of restraining her, holding her down, or physically dominating her for the purpose of the sexual act itself.
What if he left 15 minutes later?
If he had done the other acts that were terrorizing her and things like that, as he had done here, I suggest that there's enough for a jury to say that's not ordinarily incident to rape. What the commentators were making clear, and I think that they used the word ordinarily incident and the other terms to specifically say, you can't have just the act of rape, the act of taking physical dominion and control over someone, as you do in rape or robbery, and that be enough to be kidnapped. But anything else, as long as it's...
Same facts, except that he stays around the house for 5 minutes rather than 15.
Well, if he moved, but he doesn't move her or confine her in any way. I mean, if he's threatening, it gets into a lot of specifics. Does he stay in the bedroom with her with a knife and say, you're going nowhere, you're not going to report this, or whatever? Might get closer. That's not necessarily ordinarily incident to that actual physical act that it seems our code was drawn to prevent.
So
Your
position is that he would have to untie her, get dressed, and run out of the house as soon as possible in order to avoid being subject to a kidnapping?
Not necessarily, but it certainly there appears to be this dividing line between what is ordinarily incident and what is not. That line is hard to draw. I agree.
What was argued in this case, Mr. Wallace, constituted the kidnapping? Was it the taking her at knife point to the laundry room? Was that the kidnapping?
I believe probably the clearest view of it would be the taking her first from her hallway into her bedroom, raping her, and then keeping control of her, confining her to the bedroom and bathroom area, moving her to the shower, when it was clear that he was doing that for the purposes of then bringing her back to the bedroom and raping her again. I think, if I want to say what's the best, strongest kidnapping case in this, it is that part. specifically the restraint between the two rapes, the moving her about the house, bringing her back to rape her again, it was clear because the restraint was for the purpose of committing rape. That's how it was charged. So that makes it very clear that the restraint in between those two sexual episodes in the bedroom where he takes her to the bathroom, makes her shower, makes her shave, and then brings her back to the bedroom and rapes her again. That's the best, strongest case of kidnapping. That confinement, that restraint, I suggest is clear that it's not that which is ordinarily incident, as the commentators originally intended.
He was not charged with kidnapping her for the purpose of moving to the laundry room to conceal evidence of the crime, that type of thing?
Mm-hmm. No, the way it was for the purpose of sexually abusing or assaulting her, that prong. Under the indictment, as indicted, I'd say that was it.
Well, you described three events. One was moving her to the bedroom.
Yes.
And one was confining her in the bathroom area. And then the third involved later doing the laundry. What did the judge focus on? And the reason I ask the question is, by focusing on three discrete events rather than the event that constituted the kidnapping in this case, the question is, did he really kidnap her three times but was only charged once? Or what in this particular case was the specific restraint that led to the judge letting it go to the jury And what was the state's theory on this single kidnapping?
Well, my belief, and unfortunately I don't have the quote from the judge right here, but my best recollection is that he really keyed on that middle point between
the
two sexual.
In the bathroom.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The moving her to the bathroom and then bringing her back for the purpose of raping her again. He also did key on and mention the fact that the restraint continued, the confinement continued afterwards for the purpose of the cleaning up and things like that. And could this have been indicted other ways, for the purpose of terrorizing her, because he did do that and things like that, that it would have extended into those other portions?
Well, the reason that I like your view on that is because we talked about whether a single crime is continuous. So it's possible that you could kidnap someone, and you only kidnap them once. You pick them up in the morning, and you kidnap them all day. But during the course of the day, committed multiple other crimes. So we really wouldn't be focusing on different events that would constitute a kidnapping, because we know you were engaged in a kidnapping throughout the day. Then, in addition to that, there were other crimes. So I'm not suggesting you necessarily have to parse the events for the kidnapping. My question is, did you, or is that the state's contention?
No, I don't think that the state did, and I think that the best view is in those circumstances where a confinement starts, and then crimes, which would be the underlying crimes necessary for kidnapping, such as rape, occur during that continual portion of confinement occur, that it is one kidnapping. I think that's the best view, and that's the view, really, that the state went under here. But if we had to parse it and say, okay, where is it most clear that this confinement would be one that so clearly falls under kidnapping, it's that middle portion. I think all along, and I think the judge looked at it as somewhat a continual act of kidnapping where multiple sexual offenses occurred along the way, that really began from the time he took her out of the hallway and ended from the time she ran naked from her home. I see I am out of time.
Great. Thank you.
Exhibit A on the page, mini page 220, is where the court rules with respect to the kidnapping. And there he found that the victim believed that she had no choice but to submit to the defendant during the alleged sexual act, and that by virtue of the nature of the acts was restrained while the acts were being performed. Thereafter, there was restraint as she moved about her home, including into the bathroom and the shower at the defendant's instruction. His finding that the alleged she was felt compelled to submit to the sexual acts, that goes along with any particular rape where there's force used. So that does not go to assisting the state with respect to a restraint above and beyond. And again, it's the intent of the defendant there to engage in sexual conduct with her. The fact that he did it one, two, three, or four times in a short period of time and did some other conduct with her in between there does not turn this into a kidnapping. Again, this goes back to Weber. What was the point of Weber if not to show that there can be restraint throughout a house involving an ongoing set of conduct, assaultive behavior, and not be a kidnapping? That's exactly what we have here. Yes, the underlying facts are more horrendous, but the focus is not to be on that. And the fact that he's also going to receive life sentences does not undercut the fact that he is not to be convicted of any crime for which the state has not proved its case. And, of course, it's our duty to ensure that that does not occur. The state also seems to continually ignore the term substantial in substantial pain. Yes, a jury could look at the pictures, et cetera, and say, that looks like it hurt. Well, what does that mean? Is that substantial pain? No. And if substantial is to mean anything, it requires a greater showing on an objective scale in addition to the subjectiveness of the test. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you both.
The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also take a brief recess.
Rob?